Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Welcome to Meet the Press Now. I'm Kristen Welker on another day of compelling testimony from the January 6th committee. The committee's fourth hearing on its findings has just wrapped up, focusing on the Trump campaign's pressuring of state officials to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. We heard testimony from Georgia election officials, including Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, about that pressure campaign. But the star witness today was Arizona's Republican House Speaker, Rusty Bowers, who delivered powerful testimony about how former President Trump and his allies repeatedly pressed him to overturn the state's results and to violate his oath of office.
46 seconds.
You are asking me to do something that is counter to my oath when I swore to the Constitution to uphold it. On more than one occasion throughout all this, that has been brought up, and it is a tenet of my faith. That the Constitution is divinely inspired of my most basic foundational beliefs. And so for me to do that because somebody just asked me to is foreign to my very being. I will not do it.
You had told President Trump you would not do anything illegal for him.
I did, both times.
Emotional testimony there. Bowers also testified that he repeatedly asked Trump's team for evidence to back up their claims of voter fraud, but they never provided it.
At some point, did one of them make a comment that they didn't have evidence, but they had a lot of theories?
That was Mr. Giuliani.
And what exactly did he say, and how did that come up?
My recollection, he said, we've got lots of theories, we just don't have the evidence. And I don't know if that was a gaffe or maybe he didn't think through what he said, but both myself and others in my group, the three in my group and my counsel, both remembered that specifically.
Lots of theories, we just don't have evidence. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, who was threatened by Mr. Trump in a now infamous phone call to find the votes needed to overturn the results in Georgia, also testified about the fallout from his refusal to do so.
Well, after the election, my email, my cell phone was doxxed, and so I was getting texts all over the country. And then eventually, my wife started getting the text. They started going after her, I think, just to probably put pressure on me. Why don't you just quit, walk away? And so that happened. And then some people broke into my daughter-in-law's home. And my son has passed, and she's a widow. And has two kids. And so we're very concerned about her safety also.
And Mr. Secretary, why didn't you just quit and walk away?
Because I knew that we had followed the law and we had followed the Constitution. And I think sometimes moments require you to stand up and just take the shots. You're doing your job. And that's all we did. You know, we just followed the law and we followed the Constitution.
And moments ago, as today's hearing was wrapping up, an extraordinary moment, committee vice chair Congresswoman Liz Cheney used her closing statement to publicly call on Trump White House counsel Pat Cipollone to testify. To break down everything from today's hearing, I am joined now by a great team, Ali Vitale on Capitol Hill. Vaughn Hilliard is in Peoria, Illinois, where Mike Pence gave a speech last night. I'm also joined by NBC News legal analyst Carol Lamb and Tia Mitchell, Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thanks to all of you for being here on a very big and very busy day. Ali, I want to start with you. I want to get your takeaways, but before we go there, let me just get you to weigh in on what happened at the very end. Congresswoman Liz Cheney imploring former White House counsel Pat Cipollone to come and testify. Now, we've all reached out to Cipollone to see if he's going to come. What are you hearing on the Hill?
Yeah, that was a pretty stunning moment. And by the way, Kristen, if you hear any eruptions of noise behind me, it's because Congressman Jamie Raskin is gaggling with reporters right in our wake over here. So that's what that noise is going to be throughout our live shot. But I do think that that last minute plea from Congresswoman Liz Cheney for Pat Cipollone to come testify was frankly stunning. And again, another reminder of the fact that there are still people that the committee wants to hear from, even as they're already laying out this public narrative. As the vice chair of this committee was leaving the hearing room, I asked her if they could continue doing these hearings with the gaps in knowledge that they have, clearly from not speaking to Cipollone and to others. She said that they continue to be in touch with him and didn't answer when I said if they needed to pause these hearings in order to keep doing that fact finding. But really, we know that even as they're doing these hearings, they are still asking people to come before them. They are still unearthing new material. That last minute plea there only underscores that further.
It certainly does. And Ali, what were your other big takeaways today? So much happened, and there was incredibly emotional testimony at the end from Shea Moss and her mother, earlier from Rusty Bowers. Yeah. What did you make of all of it?
Yeah. Kristen, extremely emotional. And we were told last night by the committee that this would be the first time that we heard Rusty Bowers, in his own words, tell the story of what he experienced, the pressure campaign from former President Donald Trump, as well as Rudy Giuliani and others in that orbit. It was clear now, you heard the passion and the dedication in his voice as he, just like the former Pence orbit, said repeatedly, at each turn, when something new was proposed to him, he said no, and that he didn't feel that that was his power. I also thought it was particularly striking at the beginning of the hearing. They made clear, they asked the Arizona House Speaker, did he want former President Trump to win the election? He said yes. We heard this at various points over the course of this investigation from members of Congress, people who were asking the same questions that Bowers were asking. Hey, if you're seeing these signs of conspiracy, if you're seeing these signs of fraud and a rigged election, tell us where we can look for those, because they wanted to see them borne out. Ultimately, because the Trump campaign did not have any of that evidence, they were not able to do so. And that's where you saw people starting to fall away from the former president's orbit and fall away from the former president's lies. That's all very important. And I think there were two real different prongs to this hearing today. On the one hand, it was the false slates of electors campaigns, the way that those slates of electors were at least attempted to be put into the hands of the former vice president through someone like Senator Ron Johnson, although his office says that he wasn't directly involved in that, that it was staff to staff contact. Nevertheless, we saw a little bit more of the details behind that scheme. And then, of course, the other piece of it, which is that violence was sort of a feature and not a bug in this pressure campaign at the state level. Stunning testimony from people like Jocelyn Benson in Michigan, the House Speaker in Pennsylvania, of course, the election officials in Georgia, all detailing the kinds of threats that they were getting throughout this time period because of the ways the former president and his allies were both speaking to them privately and then echoing that publicly, Kristen.
Yeah, and I do want to play a little bit of sound from Rusty Bowers. We heard from him a bit at the top, but he details just how painful and how terrifying the pressure campaign became when he got personal threats. Let's play some of that.
We have various groups come by, and they have had video panel trucks with videos of me proclaiming me to be a pedophile and a pervert and a corrupt and politician, and blaring loudspeakers in my neighborhood, and at the same time, on some of these, we had a daughter who was gravely ill, who was upset by what was happening outside. And my wife, that is a valiant person, very, very strong, quiet, very strong woman. So it was disturbing. It was disturbing.
Carol Lam, it's difficult to listen to that testimony, to listen to what he went through, what Shea Moss described that she went through, which we'll delve into in just a bit. Did you hear anything that further incriminated former President Trump in the proceedings today?
Well, in a sense, everything we've heard incriminates the president. But the question is, where will this go ultimately? The purpose of these hearings is not to conduct a criminal trial. The purpose of these hearings is to put before the American people the evidence about what really happened. Whether a criminal case will ultimately be brought against anybody, and in particular President Trump, is a decision that remains with the Justice Department. And I think it's really important to manage expectations in that regard, because as devastating as this testimony is, and it is devastating, the decision whether to bring a criminal case against the president or former president of the United States is a big one. Mm-hmm. And it's one where the prosecutor, in this case Merrick Garland, has to be convinced that he can persuade a jury of 12 beyond a reasonable doubt and unanimously to convict the former president of the United States. And you heard testimony today that very rational, reasonable people said, yes, I understand that was a lie, that was a lie, that was a lie, and yet my heart tells me that this election was stolen. So emotion plays a large role in this, and I think it's important to manage expectations about what we can expect in terms of a criminal case.
Carol, as we're having this conversation, Jamie Raskin just told reporters again, after he told my colleague Chuck Todd over the weekend on Meet the Press, that they were getting new information every day. He just reiterated that. And I wonder how that fits into the call to have Pat Cipollone come and testify. Could Pat Cipollone be a game changer here in terms of a potential legal case against the former president?
Clearly, Pat Cipollone has a lot of information and could be a game changer, but you have to look at the situation that Pat Cipollone is in. He's in the president's inner circle, and that means executive privilege attaches to many of the communications that took place between them and among the staff in general. And I think that is what Pat Cipollone is really struggling with at this point in time. There are other obligations that attach. Could he say, yes, I'm doing what these other witnesses are doing, and I'm going to go ahead and testify fully in front of the committee? He could do that. Would there be ramifications to him professionally? Perhaps. This is all uncharted waters.
Tia Mitchell, you have obviously been covering everything that has unfolded with officials in Georgia quite closely. We heard from Gabriel Sterling today, in addition to Brad Raffensperger. I want to play a little bit about what Mr. Sterling had to say as it relates to the ongoing pressure campaign he was getting, where he repeatedly asked for evidence and was never given evidence. Let's play a little bit of that.
Oftentimes, I felt our information was getting out, but that there was a reticence of people who needed to believe it, because the President of the United States, who many looked up to and respected, was telling them it wasn't true. Despite the facts, the problem you have is you're getting to people's hearts. I remember there's one specific, an attorney that we know that we showed and walked him through. This wasn't true. Okay, I get that. This wasn't true. Okay, I get that. This wasn't five or six things. But at the end, he goes, I just know in my heart they cheated. That's just, and so once you get past the heart, the facts don't matter as much.
Boy, what a great way to frame that and what he was facing in that moment. What do you make of what he and Brad Raffensperger said today during their testimony? What were your key takeaways?
Yeah, my main takeaway from Secretary of State Raffensperger and Mr. Sterling was that they were up against, you know, not just Trump and his allies, but intense pressure from fellow Republicans, intense pressure from Georgia voters who are supportive of President Trump, had believed, they've been inundated with election misinformation and had begun to believe it. And so in a lot of places, he talked about it feeling like a shovel in an ocean, you know, that all the misinformation and disinformation they were trying to debunk. But Trump and the former president, had a much bigger platform. And so the lies began to outweigh the truth in so many examples. Even, you know, we're talking about a conversation that's happening among Republicans with each other. We're not even getting into what the Democrats were saying.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up that quote from Sterling about it was like trying to dig out the ocean with a shovel. It really speaks to what he was facing. I thought one of the really most extraordinary moments of today was the testimony from Shay Moss, who is an election worker who talked about why she loved her job. Her ancestors didn't have the right to vote, so she was determined to be a part of the process of voting. I want to play you a little bit of what she faced. This pressure campaign went out of nowhere. The former president, Rudy Giuliani, targeted her and her mother, falsely claiming that they were engaging in fraud, which just was not true. Take a listen.
Mr. Giuliani accused you and your mother of passing some sort of USB drive to each other. What was your mom actually handing you on that video?
A ginger mint. I felt horrible. I felt like it was all my fault. Like, if I would have never decided to be an elections worker, like, I could have done anything else. But that's what I decided to do. And now people are lying and spreading rumors and lies and attacking my mom.
Tia, this is, I think, one of the things that made her testimony so compelling. She's not an elected official. She is there basically helping the process of making sure that people can vote.
Right. And she represents the thousands of local election workers that are the backbone of our democracy. And what she highlighted was, you know, it wasn't just Ms. Moss and her mom who felt threatened. She said at one point that every election worker in her office that was in that surveillance video that Rudy Giuliani and other conservatives, you know, used as what they said was evidence of fraud, none of them are working in those jobs anymore. And not only is that, you know, to them, they've lost their livelihood. They've lost jobs that they enjoyed. But also that undermines the system. That means Fulton County has lost seasoned and educated election workers. That could lead to shortages, people who don't have as much information and experience for the next election. So in totality, it undermines our election even further because it makes it harder to get good people, fair people, people who are doing this out of a sense of love for America and democracy. You don't have as many people willing to sign up for these jobs anymore.
And Tia, that is so much at the heart of the argument that the committee is making, that they are doing this, yes, for the historic record, but also they would argue because there is an ongoing threat to the country's democracy. Von Hilliard, what is notable about the testimony today is that it was really the precursor to the hearing last week, which showcased the pressure campaign of former Vice President Mike Pence. You're in Peoria, Illinois. He was speaking there overnight. What were your key takeaways from this hearing and also what you've heard from the former vice president in his public remarks, where he did touch on January 6th, but only briefly? It's clear he wants to keep his focus on policies as he mulls his own run in 2024.
Right. This is such a multi-pronged effort, pressure campaign here. Of course, the former vice president was at the top of this pyramid, and you heard him here address a group of about 600 GOP activists last night, saying that this was time for individuals to stand by their convictions without directly talking about January 6th or these hearings or that pressure campaign placed on him. He is urging Republicans to look toward the future, a positive future, in his words here. And again, standing by their convictions, which is what he did on January 6th. But then when you listen to today, this is when we talk about the pyramid and where this pressure campaign took place. Not only was it Speaker Rusty Bowers out of Arizona, but you'll recall when Arizona Governor Doug Ducey, Kristen, was signing and certifying Arizona's election results, literally signing and certifying their results there in December of 2020, about to send them off to Washington, D.C., his phone went off. It was a phone call from the White House, from Donald Trump. They're up until that very last moment, a pressure campaign on Doug Ducey to not certify the state's election results. I was also texting with the chairman, Republican chairman of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, Clint Hickman, who at the time was also facing pressure to find a different election result. You know, he was telling me that there's that Brad Raffensperger phone call in which Donald Trump told him in Georgia to find the votes necessary to give him and give him that win in Georgia. It was that day that the story came out and that audio recording came out in which Raffensperger was pressured by Trump. Just a few hours later, Clint Hickman, the Republican chairman of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, his phone rang from the White House. He let it go to voicemail, knowing it was an extension of that pressure campaign. And the voicemail that was left for him was asking him to call back because the president wanted to talk to him. Wow. That was January 3rd, just 3 days before this pressure campaign. That is where at the county level, the state level, the governor level, to the vice president, that is where this was such a multi-pronged effort on behalf of Trump and his allies.
And it's such a smart point, Vaughn, and underscores just how widespread this pressure campaign was. All right. Fantastic conversation starting us off. Really appreciate it. Allie, Vaughn, Carol, and Tia, thanks to all of you. Coming up next, the January 6th committee today warned of the ongoing threat to democracy, as we were just talking about. I'm going to speak to the official who was in charge of Arizona's elections while everything we heard today was happening, and a legal expert about what officials can do to keep future elections from actually being stolen. You're watching Meet the Press now.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
If you want to bring coziness into your life, you turn to Barefoot Dreams. Now celebrating 30 years of coziness, Barefoot Dreams is the originator of everyone's favorite luxe home blanket. There's a reason why Barefoot Dreams has been on Oprah's Favorite Things list 6 times. Dressing head to toe in Barefoot Dreams is the key to comfort, as its ultra-soft robes, loungewear, and accessories are each made with premium materials. Get 15% off your first purchase at barefootdreams.com with the code PODCAST15.
Welcome back. As we heard throughout the hearing today, Arizona was one of the states where President Trump saw an opening to potentially flip electors and overturn the election. As we just reported, we heard testimony today from Arizona House Speaker Rusty Bowers detailing how Trump and his advisors pushed Bowers to help overturn the results of the 2020 election. Bowers refused at every turn, even after 2 calls from the president and another from his lawyer, John Eastman. Take a listen.
And what did Dr. Eastman want you to do?
That we would, in fact, take a vote to overthrow, or I shouldn't say overthrow, that we would decertify the electors, and that because we had plenary authority to do so.
In your view, what he was asking you to do would have violated your oath to the Constitution, both the United States Constitution and the Constitution of the State of Arizona.
Yes, sir.
I'm joined now by Arizona Secretary of State Katie Hobbs and election law expert Rick Hassan. Thanks to both of you for being here. So, Secretary Hobbs, I want to start with you and get your reaction to what you heard today. What were the key takeaways for you, and was there anything that was revelatory that you weren't aware of?
Well, I think what was so compelling was hearing personally from these individuals just how much pressure there was, and that it was so blatant how these folks, Giuliani and Trump, were asking them to blatantly break the law. And he clearly stated that back to them, no, I'm not going to do that. And that, I think, is what's so compelling about what we've heard today.
And Rick, for you, what were your key takeaways? I mean, did you hear anything that put the former president in greater legal jeopardy, or was this more about filling in the details of the pressure campaign?
Well, I think that, you know, the takeaway for me, similar to the secretary, it was the relentlessness of the efforts. You know, we heard today about Arizona and Georgia, but clearly this was happening in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, you know, in whatever states could potentially be flipped. And it sure looks like a conspiracy to subvert the election outcomes, to interfere with official proceedings, the kinds of things that could open up Trump and his key allies to criminal liability.
You know, there was that stunning moment at the end of the hearing where you had the vice chair, Liz Cheney, asking former White House counsel Pat Cipollone to come and testify. Rick, if that happens, how significant would that be? Could that be a game changer in these proceedings?
Well, you know, having him in the room where he can come and say, I was in the room when Donald Trump heard this and that, and to have him live there, I think, would be a dramatic moment. They already have a lot of information. We saw Bill Barr, for example, on tape. So I don't think it's a make or break moment. But I think the fact that Liz Cheney called him out publicly to do this is really trying to put the pressure on him. And we'll see what happens in the next hearing.
Secretary Hobbs, the theory of the case that the Trump team was making was that somehow they could find new electors, fake electors, and supplant them with the existing electors. How aware were you at the time that this was going on, and what do you make of this theory?
Well, we knew that in Arizona there were two slates of fake electors that submitted their names to the tried to submit their names to the archives, and we, you know, report on those at the time. I think that the legislature has the authority to dictate how electors are chosen, but once we're in the middle of the game, they can't change the rules, and the electors had already been chosen, and so there was no authority to change that. Now, there's been since legislation presented to try to allow the legislature to do that, but it has not so far been approved in Arizona.
And Secretary Hobbs, I'm sure you know Mr. Bauer as well. He spoke so personally and emotionally today about his faith. And one of the points that the committee was making was that if someone had been in that position who was different, who viewed this differently, there could have been a very different outcome. What can you fill in about the blanks of who he is, who made him make that decision that he made to stand his ground?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. He is an honorable man. And I think if you look at the Capitol across the mall, at what was going on in the Senate at the same time and trying to subpoena all of the ballots and equipment in Maricopa County that led to the sham audit that played out in Arizona last summer. And Speaker Bowers was like, no, we're not going to dishonor this chamber in that way. We're not going to bring that circus here. I think he said that today. And so I think there's a stark contrast in leadership and someone who was willing to stand on his principles versus caving to the pressure of the members of his caucus and other leaders.
Well, committee chairman and Congressman Benny Thompson said in his opening statement today, quote, our institutions held in the days before and during January 6th, but that they're under attack from people who are eroding them from within, who are undermining every election without basis. Take a listen to a little bit more of what he had to say.
The lie hasn't gone away. It's corrupting our democratic institutions. People who believe that lie are now seeking positions of public trust. And as seen in New Mexico, their oath to be to the people they serve will take a back seat to their commitment to the big lie. If that happens, who will make sure our institutions don't break under the pressure? We won't have close calls. We'll have a catastrophe.
Rick, that's really the crux of part of what the committee is arguing here, isn't it?
Well, I think really, Representative Schiff made this point at the end of the hearing, really, we could look at the hearing as primarily looking back at the past and figure out whether anyone is going to pay some kind of criminal penalty for what was done or some other kind of penalty. But really what we have to do is look to the future and think about what can be done so that it becomes harder to subvert an election. You could think of 2020 as a dry run for 2024. And those heroes from, you know, the election workers to the secretaries of state to the members of the state legislatures who stood up to Trump and said, no, we're not going to break the law. Those people might not be in power in all of these states next time around. And we can't have a system that depends on personal heroism as a way of protecting our democracy. We need stronger rules in place.
And stronger rules, does that mean amending the Electoral Count Act? Are there other actions that you think need to be taken, Rick?
Certainly, I think the Electoral Count Act needs to be fixed. It's a law that dates back to 1887, and it's very hard even for experts in the field to understand. Things can be done to clarify that the vice president doesn't have the power to just throw out Electoral College votes. But there's other things to do. One that became clear from the testimony at the end of the hearing was protecting election workers from threats of violence. I mean, this is a huge problem, and we saw it across the country, these kinds of protests. And there's other things to do, too. I think every state should be required to use voting machines that produce a piece of paper that could be counted in the event of a recount. Wholly electronic voting machines just create a system where people are not going to necessarily trust the results. So there's really a lot that can be done. And fortunately, we've heard that there are conversations going on a bipartisan basis between Democratic and Republican senators to try to craft a narrow anti-election subversion bill to try to get through the Congress this year before the next elections.
Secretary Hobbs, how critical is that, and how big of a threat do you think still exists in your own state?
It's absolutely critical, and we are still facing a threat. And I think that's one of the things that is highlighted by these hearings, is that this is not about one day. These attacks on America happened on January 6th. They were happening before, leading up to it, and they're continuing to happen. And we have to take serious action to address that and to curtail that threat. As Rick mentioned, if other people were in these offices, we might not be in the same position today.
Well, it's a really stark but important point that you are both making, and I appreciate your both being here today. Rick Hassin and Secretary of State Katie Hobbs, who's running for governor in Arizona. Thank you both. Next, we will have more on the revelations and the political fallout ahead. Plus, if it's Tuesday, voters are voting, and Steve Kornacki will be at the big board with what we're watching, including the race to take on one of today's witnesses, Brad Raffensperger, in November. You're watching Meet the Press now. As we say around here, if it's Tuesday, somebody is voting somewhere. And today that somewhere is Alabama and Georgia, which have runoff elections today, as well as Virginia. And right here in Washington, D.C., where polls are open for primary elections. As the January 6th committee continues to outline the lengths the former president took to overturn the results of 2020's free and fair election, it's hard to forget that Trump is still a key motivating factor in Republican races, as we were just discussing right here, including the most high-profile race today, the Republican Senate runoff in Alabama between the Trump-endorsed candidate Katie Britt and the formerly Trump-endorsed Congressman Mo Brooks. Trump pulled his backing when Brooks started to sag in the polls. NBC's Steve Kornacki is, of course, at the big board for us today with more on today's races and some Trump-charged races still to come this summer. So, Steve, what are you watching and what's the big headline out of Alabama right now?
Yeah, Kristen, well, you set it up pretty well there. It's been a saga. It's been a drama there. Mo Brooks, Donald Trump, that relationship, Brooks getting the Trump endorsement, losing the Trump endorsement, still a couple weeks ago in a bit of a surprise, making his way into the runoff here. He finished second, a bit of a distant second to Katie Britt in the initial round of voting, but neither got 50%. So to the runoff we went, and then Mo Brooks made a very public plea to Donald Trump to reconsider, to re-endorse him in the runoff. Trump responded by saying, no thanks, I'm going to endorse Katie Britt. So Britt led in the preliminary. She got about 45% of the vote. She now has the Trump endorsement, so certainly she is the favorite coming into tonight's election here in Alabama, runoff election. We'll see what happens. Obviously, this is to replace the retiring Richard Shelby, a Republican winner here, heavy favorite in the fall in a heavily Republican state. There are some congressional primaries we're going to be watching as well. You mentioned Virginia. Let's start there because there are two districts tonight where Republicans are picking candidates and where Republicans believe they have very golden pickup opportunities in the fall. Two districts that could go a long way towards determining House control. Number one is right down here, the second district. This is the Virginia Beach area. Now, the Democratic incumbent here is Elaine Luria. She was elected in 2018 in that Democratic wave. She was reelected in 2020. Now she faces a different political climate. This district swung hard towards Glenn Youngkin, the Republican who won last year's gubernatorial election in Virginia. Here's the Republican roster tonight. We'll see who emerges from this. National Republicans would like to see this candidate, Jen Kiggins, a state senator, win in this primary. They think she is their best chance. The other district we'll be talking about a lot this November in Virginia, the 7th district. Again, the incumbent here is a Democrat who was elected in that wave of 2018, Abigail Spanberger. She's trying to defend another district that swung hard towards Glenn Youngkin last year. You could see here the Republican field in this race, who will be nominated. Again, race we'll be watching closely this fall. One more congressional primary. It's a runoff to tell you about in Georgia tonight. See if we can get this one called up here. The 2nd District of Georgia. This one is worth looking at, too. This is a seat held for the last 30 years by Democrat Sanford Bishop. This is one that Republicans think, because of redistricting, they may have a shot at in the fall. So we'll be keeping an eye on this one tonight as well. And the broader context, Kristen, here, we're sort of coming toward the end of the toward the end of the spring primary season. We just wanted to put the list up quickly here. These are the 10 Republicans who voted for impeachment, how they've been doing in their primaries. Obviously, the story of August, four of them to come, will be decided then.
Yep, that says it all. We'll be watching those races very closely. Steve Kornacki, thank you. Another busy night for you. Appreciate it. Still ahead, new revelations and what's now being called law enforcement's abject failure to respond to the school massacre in Uvalde, Texas. That's next.
There's compelling evidence that the law enforcement response to the attack at Robb Elementary was an abject failure and antithetical to everything we've learned over the last two decades since the Columbine massacre.
Welcome back. Well, you just heard it there. Abject failure. That is what the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, Stephen McCraw, called the law enforcement response to the Uvalde shooting that killed 19 children and two teachers last month. In testimony before a state Senate committee investigating the shooting, McCraw accused the on-scene commander of placing the lives of officers over the lives of children.
One error, 14 minutes and 8 seconds. That's how long the children waited and the teachers waited in rooms 111 to be rescued. And while they waited, the on-scene commander waited for a radio and rifles. Then he waited for shields. Then he waited for SWAT. Lastly, he waited for a key that was never needed.
So difficult to hear that. Joining me now for more on these really tough details is NBC's investigative correspondent Tom Winter. Tom, thanks for being here. What are your key takeaways from McCraw's testimony today? What did we learn? And it seems like every detail that we learn about the law enforcement response is worse than the next.
That's a perfect way to put it, Kristen. And literally every single sentence today contained new information that just made this this whole tragedy somehow worse. We had heard before that they were waiting for some sort of a ballistic shield, something that could take a bullet while they entered the classroom. Well, today we found out for sure that not only did they have a ballistic shield relatively early on into their response, approximately 20, 25 minutes into the response, but they ended up getting four of them. They had a Halligan tool, which is named after the fire firefighter in New York that invented it. It's something you or I could put into a door and using the proper force break it open. And then we learned that that wasn't needed at all. Neither were keys needed at all, because according to McGraw, the door likely was never locked in the first place and nobody needed a key to open it. What made it even worse, according to McGraw, is that nobody even checked to see if it was unlocked, that somebody could open it. And from a school safety standpoint, Kristen, and there was a whole lot of discussion about this, the things that were not done to properly prepare this school for seemingly any sort of incident, according to the Texas Department of Public Safety, but that door could only be locked from the outside. So presumably in an active shooter situation, a teacher would have to actually go to the door, lock it from the outside, and then go back in. It was something that really seemed to confound him. One of the things I think was most interesting about this transcript does not rely on the sworn statement of any single police officer or member of that school. According to the Texas Department of Public Safety, they solely relied on surveillance camera, body-worn camera video. On top of that, the 911 call transcripts, as well as radio communications between officers, although it appears that the school police officers' radio systems, did not even work inside of the school. So it'll be interesting to see if they even tested that before that fateful day. Like I said, I could go on, but a lot of tough revelations.
It really, really are. Tom, where does the investigation go next?
So the closed door Texas House investigation is continuing. That was where the police chief of the Uvalde Independent School District testified today. Behind closed doors, no cameras. He did not answer any reporters' questions leaving that today, according to our team on the ground there. So that will continue going forward. There is the district attorney is leading an ongoing investigation. And then, as we've talked about before, Kristen, the Department of Justice's community-oriented policing office will be taking a look at this response as more of an after action report.
All right. Well, Tom Winter, you have been all over this from the very beginning. We really appreciate your great reporting. Thank you. And thank you for being with us this hour. We'll be back tomorrow with more Meet the Press Now. NBC News Now coverage continues with Hallie Jackson right now.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.